Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. As we often debate possible improvements to the U.S. Constitution, is it worth looking at the new Constitution of Venezuela, which creates rights to education, housing, health care, and a sustainable environment?
People want to rewrite or scrap the U.S. Constitution and make it a people's document. And this person was talking about how Iceland is rewriting their constitution online. You know, the people are putting in their input and they're doing it through the internet.
Right.
And I said, how can you forget the Bolivarian constitution of Venezuela, where, you know, the people elected a constitutional committee and the representatives of the people went in, and after it was written, it had to be approved by the people, by a referendum of the people.
Venezuela's move toward greater democracy has happened under the presidency of Hugo Chavez.
Even though he made some very provocative remarks about George Bush, I mean, I can't really blame him for that, because I also have made some very provocative remarks about George Bush and the U.S. empire.
Well, who hasn't? Does Venezuela offer an example for the United States to follow, one that the United States government might find dangerous?
If Venezuela can close the education gap, if they can close the income gap, if they could close the democracy gap, then why can't we do it here in the United States?
I am delighted to say that my guest this week is Cindy Sheehan, a leading peace activist and author who lost her son to the war on Iraq. Her radio show is at cindysheehansoapbox.com. Her new Kindle book is called Revolution, A Love Story. Cindy, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's nice to talk to you, as always. And my book, Revolution, A Love Story, is also available on Amazon. So if people would rather have a hard copy, they can order a copy at Amazon.
Oh, terrific. And what is Revolution, A Love Story about?
Revolution, A Love Story is about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. It's about dispelling the myths about Hugo Chavez that we're constantly bombarded with in the U.S. media. Well, actually, you know, pretty much the worldwide media. And it's about also trying to inspire people here in the United States that if Venezuela can close the education gap, if they can close the income gap, if they could close the democracy gap, then why can't we do it here in the United States?
There seems to be sort of a common understanding across the political spectrum in the United States that Hugo Chavez has done some good things and some bad things, and he's, you know, been good for Venezuela, but he's a crazy dictator. You've been in touch with him, you've met with him, you've spent time with him, you've studied this and written a book about it. What is your take on Hugo Chavez?
Well, you know, he's actually not crazy, first of all. He's very, very dignified head of state. And even though he made some very provocative remarks about George Bush, I mean, I can't really blame him for that, because I also have made some very provocative remarks about George Bush and the U.S. empire. You know, the democracy thing is that Lula, who was president of Brazil, said that Venezuela has an excess of democracy. They always have elections. And not only has Hugo Chavez been reelected, but he survived a recall attempt, and he survived a coup attempt. And so our own Jimmy Carter was down in Venezuela during the recall attempt and certified that those elections were valid. So, you know, of course, if a person survives many elections and a coup attempt, you can't really call that person a dictator.
Yes, good point. Jimmy Carter, who says that our U.S. election system is not even plausibly credible or worthy of being observed for
right. Possible
verifiability. So the coup attempt is something that we should maybe go into a little bit more, in that this is a coup attempt with U.S. support? What has been the U.S. role in Venezuela in recent years?
Well, the U.S., of course, worked with the opposition in 2002, and the U.S. recognized, after the coup attempt, they recognized the illegitimate government, and the biggest part the U.S. has played in Venezuela is the part that the U.S. is playing in many countries around the world, and that's funding an organization called National Endowment for Democracy, or USAID. And what they do is they've spent millions of dollars in Venezuela trying to undermine the Bolivarian Revolution and the presidency or the government of Hugo Chavez, because, of course, it's not just Hugo Chavez. His party has about 60% control of the legislature. So in the United States, it's illegal for foreign entities or foreign people to donate to campaigns. But what the United States does is they send money to NED, and NED funds opposition groups and opposition campaigns.
This is NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, which gets funding from the AFL-CIO, among other places. While we cheer when labor unions are not gung-ho for every war, they are engaged in this this kind of funding. And has this changed in our turnover from the Bush years to the Obama years?
No, actually, Obama's administration has funded the opposition in Venezuela still. And you know, I don't have the exact number right at the tip of my fingers of the millions of dollars that they put into it. But, you know, a good source for that information would, of course, be my book, but also Eva Golinger, who exposed connection between the United States and the coup attempt. She has a blog called Chavez Code, and she is always really on top of, you know, U.S. hanky-panky in Venezuela.
Cindy Sheehan's new book is called Revolution, A Love Story. So how did you come to meet and speak with Hugo Chavez?
When I was right after Camp Casey in the summer of 2005, I was invited to go to the World Social Forum in Caracas. So I went down there, and I was involved in a rally that he gave, and then I was invited to the presidential palace, Miraflores, to meet with him. Then I was also on his show, Alo Presidente, and he always called George Bush Senor Peligro, which means Mr. Danger. And at the first rally we had together, he dubbed me Senora Esperanza, which means Mrs. Hope. And so after I was there in 2006, I came home to the United States to, of course, a lot of right-wing criticism, but I was already used to that. But what surprised me was the criticism I was getting from the so-called left about meeting with President Chavez. So I just started to do a lot of research into the topic of Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution, because, you know, I could get that the enemy of my enemy didn't necessarily have to be my friend, but I really wanted to find out why these so-called leftists were opposed to Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution. I talk in my book about how right after I was in Caracas, I was summoned to meet with Arianna Huffington, and she really scolded me for meeting with him. And so I was shocked at that. And so I started to do more research, and I was relieved to find that my support of Chavez and the revolution, to me, I found it to be justified. And so in 2010, as part of my radio show, I petitioned the government of Venezuela to be able to go to Venezuela to interview President Chavez for my radio show. And I spent a lot of time, you know, not a terrible amount of time, but like 8 days in Venezuela, talking to him, talking to other members of his administration, speaking to people in the barrios of Venezuela, and traveling around, going down to Uruguay with Chavez on his presidential plane to attend the inauguration of Pepe Mujica, who was the new president of Uruguay, who was a freedom fighter, and a former freedom fighter. And so anyway, I got to spend a lot of time not just with Chavez, but noticing and observing how people react to him. When we were in Montevideo, he would just get out of his car and just charge into the crowds and the cheering crowds. And people would shake hands with him and hug him and pat his back. I can't imagine a U.S. president doing that anywhere, not even in the United States.
No, there's a man on trial for having touched Vice President Cheney. It's a different world up here. We're speaking with Cindy Sheehan about Hugo Chavez. Her new book is Revolution, A Love Story. One thing I'm amazed by is that Venezuela, like many countries, has developed a new constitution and has even amended it since adopting it. And it has all kinds of rights and features that we don't even dream of as being possible here. Can you describe what the new constitution does?
I'm like on this email list about this new constitutional committee. People want to rewrite or scrap the U.S. Constitution and make it a people's document. And this person was talking about how Iceland is rewriting their constitution online. You know, the people are putting in their input and they're doing it through the internet.
Right.
And I said, how can you forget the Bolivarian constitution of Venezuela, where, you know, the people elected a constitutional committee and the people went in, the representatives of the people went in, and after it was written, it had to be approved by the people, by a referendum of the people. And, you know, like you said, it has been amended since then. And the only way the Bolivarian constitution can be amended is by a referendum of the people. And it goes to a vote to all of the eligible voters in Venezuela. And, of course, you know that our constitution was written over 200 years ago. It's been amended about, 28 times. And the only way it can be amended is realistically through the establishment. And of course, ever since 9/11, the presidents and the establishment have worked really hard to make the Constitution meaningless anyway. And in the Bolivarian Constitution, human rights are enshrined. You know, the right to an education, the right to health care, the right to food, the right to housing. Even the protection of the environment is enshrined in the Bolivarian Constitution. And there's five branches of government, and one of the branches is the people power. And that's made up of neighborhood councils. And, you know, people in Venezuela, people always talk about Hugo Chavez, you know, being this, autocrat or something, where he's not really. He made education his first priority because he understood an educated populace would be more involved in the political process. And, you know, that's exactly what's happening. The government of Venezuela and the people of Venezuela share in power. And I think it might have taken a very charismatic personality like Chavez to turn their country away from the oligarchy that was in cahoots with the United States for, you know, many, many decades, and if not centuries, and to turn it around, to start sharing that power and to start sharing the resources. Hugo Chavez has not stopped oil companies from profiting in Venezuela. What he has done is made them adhere to the taxation code and to share their profits with Venezuela and with the people of Venezuela.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story and a remarkable book you've written. There are these positive rights, economic rights in the Constitution and in current policy, equal rights for women, which we haven't even gotten to yet, the right to recall the president and so forth.
And indigenous rights are very important also in Venezuelan Constitution.
I guess it to the extent that we can get people to look at that constitution with an open mind, it suggests a model of where we might want to take our constitution. But then the big question many people may have is, how did Venezuela get there? What was the process, the movement that brought about this change?
Well, you know, and that's I think that is the question, David. I think that's what we really need to study if we ever hope to get to the same level. The first thing we have to overcome, I think, in this country is the cult of the Constitution. In many, many countries, our Constitution, when it was written, was a very liberal document, especially with the addition of the Bill of Rights. But of course, the main body of the Constitution, I think, was designed to keep this white male power structure intact. And every single time that we've had, the civil rights movement, the blacks, the right to vote, women, the right to vote, it hasn't been without this terrible struggle with a lot of sacrifices on the side of people who want to enter into the process. Our Constitution is not a sacred, holy, religious document. It's a document that may have worked over 200 years ago, but now with the process of amending it so out of our reach, the everyday, Americans' reach, I think that we do have to look at how did Venezuela totally scrap their constitution. And, of course, their constitution that they scrapped was only written in the early 1960s. So Venezuela has a history of rewriting constitutions, of course. And so President Chavez, after this event in the late 80s in Venezuela called the Caracazo, where the president of the time, his name was Carlos Andres Perez, he reneged on a campaign promise that he wouldn't take any money from the IMF or World Bank. And so he reneged on that promise. And one of the requirements for the loans to Venezuela was that Venezuela would stop the subsidy of fuel. And so one day, fuel prices were very low. Transportation prices, like to get on the bus, were very low. The next day, they were increased dramatically. So the people had an uprising over that. And Perez sent in the military and killed a few thousand Venezuelans. And Chavez happened to be in the military at the time, but he was ill with chicken pox. And so he didn't take part in suppressing the rebellions, but he was appalled by the rebellions. And he had already been in communication with some other officers in the Venezuelan military about this movement, this Bolivarian movement to take back the country of Venezuela from this oligarchy. And so they actually tried a military coup that did not work, and he was put in prison for 3 years. And when he got out, he started traveling the country to consolidate political power around this new idea of a Bolivarian movement. And he started to run for president, which was a real, very gutsy move, of course. And he was getting more and more and more support. And one of his promises was the first thing he was going to do would be to, elect a constitutional convention. And he won in 1998. In 1999, the constitutional convention started. The constitution was rewritten. The people of Venezuela overwhelmingly approved it. And, ever since, he's been struggling to implement the ideas of the Bolivarian Constitution.
It's a remarkable story that is well told in the book Revolution, A Love Story by our guest Cindy Sheehan. This is Talk Nation Radio with David Swanson. I think it's remarkable as well that he did not get in through a violent coup, but through a nonviolent movement and instituted democratic reforms approved by the people, in that there's been this argument for some decades from some on the left that, you know, governments that strive to put in place economic rights have to do so at the expense of political rights, or they're subject to being overthrown by the United States. So, you know, Castro has outlasted Allende, supposedly because there was democracy in Chile. Kermit Roosevelt was able to overthrow the democratically elected president of Iran, but not mm-hmm. not the leader of Syria and so forth. But maybe that's not right. Maybe popular support today is enough to protect a leader of a government that the United States is out to get.
Well, the U.S. has worked very, very hard in Venezuela to undermine Hugo Chavez, and there's a new election coming up in October in Venezuela, and I'm actually a little more interested in that one than I am our own election in November. But the media in Venezuela, most of it is dedicated to the undermining of the Bolivarian Revolution and of Hugo Chavez too. So, you know, we've seen that his support, which has sometimes been as high as 80%, has, you know, dwindled down sometimes to around 50%, which is still a really good, you know, really good numbers. But it's very concerning that the U.S. still works really, really hard to undermine, and it works. You know, it's been working sometimes. The media has been chipping away at Chavez's support. But I think the biggest mistake that the United States made was in 2002 was trying to overthrow him, because the people, even people who didn't give Chavez their 100% undying support, said that we're a sovereign country. The people of Venezuela put him in power. How dare the United States try to remove him from power? And it really was the people of Venezuela. Chavez was just hours away from being executed, but the people went, you know, by the tens of thousands to surround the palace and say, we want our president back. And if that hadn't have happened, you know, Chavez wouldn't have been able to return to power. But I think that is something that the people of Venezuela are very proud of. It's something that Chavez acknowledges all the time, that he owes his life to the people of Venezuela, so he will be happy to give his life to them. So, you know, it's a real special relationship that they have, but it's not one that is invulnerable to U.S. hanky-panky.
So why is it, you know, for listeners who believe the U.S. government is a force for good in the world, or that, or are not clear on exactly what evil intentions are afoot, why is it that the U.S. government is working so hard to overthrow a president if he is as good as you say?
Well, because, you know, being good. Let's just talk in terms of the 1% and the 99% that the Occupy Wall Street has coined. Chavez is able to stay in power because the people in the 99%, you know, feel like he has immeasurably improved their lives. And, you know, it has been, the improvement has been measurable. There are, you know, indicators that the international community measures that has shown that Venezuela has reduced their income gap by over 50%, where the U.S.'s income gap is widening to one where it's the widest income gap of any so-called industrialized nation. Venezuela went from a country where most of the people were illiterate to one that has recently met international literacy standards. So the people you know, the people who he has helped, they know that now they have a house because of him. Now they have, their teeth are healthy, their bodies are healthy, their minds are improving because of him. So that's why he's able to stay in power. But there's one thing that is very annoying to the empire, and that's when a nation does not feel like its resources belong to the United States of America. When I was researching for the book, I watched George Tenet. He was at a hearing in the Senate, I think, and he actually said that Hugo Chavez doesn't put the interests of the United States above the interests of Venezuela. And to our 1%, that is a big affront, that Chavez would think that the oil of Venezuela belongs to the people of Venezuela, or their natural resources or their wealth belong to the people of Venezuela. And one reason I think that we can't really talk about the Bolivarian Revolution without talking about the Cuban Revolution, because the Cuban Revolution was a great inspiration to the Bolivarian Revolution. And it just boggles my mind that decades of this embargo or blockade against Cuba and this demonization of Castro and the Cuban Revolution is still alive and well in the year 2012. But I think back in the 60s, the U.S. government was afraid that what has happened would happen, and that's that the Cuban Revolution would inspire other Latin American countries to finally realize that they are not putative colonies of the United States.
What if Hugo Chavez dies? What's at risk if he is unelected in October, or as he has had cancer and is growing older, what if he dies?
It's my thought that if he does die, that there is enough energy and allegiance to the Constitution and to the sovereignty of Venezuela and to what the Bolivarian Revolution has tried to do, that it will continue. Even, I think, if he loses the election to the opposition, you know, once the people had their rights enshrined to education, healthcare, housing, you know, et cetera, I think that they're not going to go back easily. And they have proven that they will rise up peacefully. He has a legacy that can never be killed. So I hope, along with you, that that legacy would inspire the people of the United States to realize that education, healthcare, peace, you know, we haven't even talked about peace. Venezuela has never since the revolution been involved in a war, and the revolution was back in the late 1700s. And until we can crack that shell of even people here in the 99% think that these things are privileges when they're actually human rights. And we have to really crack through that if we're going to make progress.
Beautifully said. Cindy Sheehan, a great activist, a great author. I highly recommend her new book, Revolution, A Love Story. Cindy, thanks for being with us on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's always good to talk to you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.